minutes from the last meeting. Eric, I did them in two formats. Could you open up at least one of them?
Yes.
Okay. Any corrections? Joe, thank you so much. There was a ton of information in there from our process the last time.
One of them was a DOCX form.
Right.
And one of them
was a DOC.
It said DOC, but it didn't. The file format was not, in fact, DOC. The word wouldn't open it.
I'm confused. Your computer doesn't like me. What version of Word do you have?
Oh, I think it's Word 2000 or something like that.
Oh, it's very old.
Then
you know what, Eric? One thing I might be able to do is I will scan it to myself and email it to you as a PDF. I'm sure you can open it.
That'll certainly work.
Let's try that.
What I could do is take the DOCX, and there's a website that will convert it for free. It just takes an extra 30 seconds.
Right. All right. All right. Any changes in the notes, which were really good? Okay. Considered approved. We'll set that aside. Now, there's a couple things that happened today that I think are relevant for us to know about as we work through the process. That's okay. That's all right. That's all right.
That's important.
Let's go around. Now, Judge Rossiter's coming. She said she'd be a few minutes late. But one of the things that we're going to do today is we did the process with the Sheriff's Department last time from the time they respond to a call to arrest and arraign or release with an appearance ticket, and Sergeant Van walked us through that. So Sergeant John Norman is here from the Ithaca Police Department, and Judge Rossiter will be here, and they're going to talk about the IPD process. And I thought we'd go around the room so the sergeant can, know who all we are.
I am Deb Dietrich with OAR.
Linda Riley, mental health.
Susan Bell, public.
Eric Lerner, technically public, but once upon a time I was OAR, and once upon a time I was Board of Representatives, which is nowadays legislature.
Jason Leifer, attorney.
Paula Yonida, community member.
Zappy Mosey, Human Services Coalition.
Angela Sullivan, Alcohol and Drug Council.
Pat Bierschall, Probation Director.
Marsha?
Marsha Lynch, Public Information.
I'm Joe Mariani, the County Minister.
We couldn't do this without. And you know me because you're my neighbor. So, the Downtown Initiative just had a meeting talking about how to deal with mental health issues in the community and some initiatives they've been following from Burlington and some other places. I know a few of you went.
Do you want the handout to copy?
I will be happy to copy and distribute to everyone else. And if you can fill us in, I could not go. And I thought, we will get the information, bring it to the team, and hear what they're trying to do, because it's kind of in line with us. So feel free. Anybody start?
Well, they did a field trip to Burlington, Vermont, which is comparable to Ithaca. It has a population of about 42,000. It has a pedestrian mall that is larger than our commons. Burlington is the largest city in Vermont. And of course, Ithaca isn't the largest city in New York, but there's a college there. So there's very, very typical things, and they were experiencing problems with hanging out. And it tended not to rise to the level of a criminal offense, but it was more mental health issues, substance abuse issues, or other social service kinds of needs issues. So in 2000, they initially formed a task for an outreach team of one person who would go and respond to law enforcement, merchants, and other folks in the community in this area to sort of engage and try to help with whatever the issues were to decrease the annoyance, disturbance, whatever other words they use.
Behavioral problems.
As of 2012, they had 5.5 full-time equivalent staff. They pretty much work almost around the clock.
Yeah, they had two after-hour
people who are more proactive than reactive. So they go out and seek out potential issues rather than wait to address the issue after it's arisen. They have multiple funding sources. The oversight for them is the city government.
Oh, wow.
It didn't sound like
not
they were
like
professionals.
A mental health department?
No, it didn't sound like they were professionals, actually. It sounded like it was more like an enhanced case management program to me, actually. And they did a lot of linkage and education and that kind of stuff.
So basically, we're trying to focus on the kind of the frequent flyers. They all knew in the community who those people were. And it was like 25 people, top people, that all were, seemed like were causing mm-hmm. behavioral problems.
Which we know, too.
Yeah. But I like the after-hour stuff because they would, like, go to the people's homes and check up on them. Are you taking your medication? Are you, you know, and they would try to do more preventative stuff.
Yeah. One of the things that was interesting on the in the very beginning pages of that document, it talks about most of the people weren't linked to services. So
yeah.
It's interesting that how are you taking your medication if you're not linked to services,
right.
You know, so.
Some of them didn't have medication.
So they got
right. So they would link them to services.
Oh, cool. And they said that they had reduced their, like, police volume for mental health calls by 80%.
80%.
Right. That's,
yeah.
like, huge.
Right. I mean, still the law enforcement still had the most dealings with the individuals. Merchants were, once the team was established, the merchants would not call 911 or law enforcement. They would call the team directly. So that was part of how the reduction in calling the law enforcement personnel happened, because they would circumvent that, because it wasn't a criminal issue. It was more a behavioral issue.
They weren't committing crimes. They were just
being annoying,
like yelling. And,
yeah.
And what they had is, it wasn't like the outreach team aren't professionals who are, you know, social workers or anything.
Right.
It's like the first guy was someone who come out of having homelessness issues himself, substance abuse, and alcoholism. So, I mean, it kind of, so it wasn't quite like the idea of the social worker knocking at your door in the middle of the night and seeing if you're taking your meds. It was more of a relationship was established between the outreach workers and the clients or the folks who needed help.
Jill?
I'm not always totally miserly, but a core population of 25 individuals who were frequent flyers and an FTE contingent of 5.5 people to deal with that? Is that what I...
As of 2012.
Like, was it grant money?
There was no
sources.
Federal money, but there was state money, the community banks, the...
Merchants?
Yeah, I had the number wrong.
Community health foundation.
It could have been more than, maybe it was 25 in Ithaca. Maybe it was more there.
No, they talked about 25 frequent flyers. I mean, that was, but there were a larger population,
yeah.
but the majority of calls going to law enforcement about these behavioral issues were tended to be these 25-ish.
I don't even know if they got 25 on the count.
But as more and more people are being released from the mental institutions back into the community
right.
again, and from the forensic mental institutions too, we're going to see an increase in the number of disturbances in the downtown area. I mean, it's also because transportation was mentioned. I mean, people come in from the outlying towns for an appointment, and there's not a bus back home until the end of the day. So stuff happens.
Yeah.
No place to go.
So what were next steps? How did they leave it?
Well, get back together and start brainstorming.
And how to
the Downtown Ithaca Association has pledged $10,000 for this initiative, and they're looking for other partners. And
one person is what they're looking for initially.
Jill gets
us.
They're looking for a county partner, I'll tell you.
Yeah. But
did
one person.
Did they talk about Disrupt? Did they talk about the diversion? Because that's always in a community, they're having all these parallel conversations, and one of the ones I was at yesterday, and forgive me, I can't remember what it all stands for, but basically it's like cutting readmits of sort of costly Medicaid and so forth, and they're required to provide a model for behavioral health. So that's actually something that they're putting together and have to target a program.
Yeah, that wasn't mentioned, but that may come up in future discussion.
So, yes.
When you say they are required to, who's that?
It's a long discussion, but New York got a Medicaid waiver, and so we're sort of designing our own approaches to cut Medicaid costs, and there are regional groupings that are starting to happen. So I was at a meeting at the hospital, and so if we submit a letter of intent for Thompson, right now it's Tompkins Schuyler, it might expand beyond that, they have to have a component to address substance abuse and behavioral health issues.
Eric
in their plan.
Who's they?
They
is the compendium or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
The
consortium. Of everybody who was at a table. So it could be anybody, really.
And Joe Paul will get back to you about the $50,000 she promised.
And again, I'm in bean counter mode because we're in this budget cycle. I'm talking to bean counter mode anyway. But, I mean, each individual that we would bring on, I mean, if it's at county scale, it's probably $75,000 in salaries and fringes.
You're talking about
I think it's more city scale, though, actually.
But, I mean, I'm thinking of the 5.5 individuals.
Right. Well, I think they probably started
small. And they started
small.
With one.
They started with one.
And
right, they were talking one.
Non-profit, cheaper.
Yeah.
We have lower overhead.
Yeah, but...
Okay, so it sounds like it's a work in progress. It's just starting, and right now it's getting the information out there and figuring out. You know, I'll have to figure out how many people we'd be talking about.
There was general support for the idea of and their first goal was really linking people to the needed services. The secondary goal was to modify and to reduce the behavioral issues. So, I mean, you know, if it keeps the police from having to be involved as often, that's, I think, a good start. And there's general support for it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Thanks. And thank
so
you
just
guys
get that
for coming. Definitely. Oh, yeah. I'll copy that.
Thank you.
The other thing I did copy, this was news to me, it's probably not news to anybody else, was this powdered alcohol stuff. And it looks like it was approved, and then they kind of pulled the approval when everybody started screaming, as well they should. Powdered alcohol. The new Pixie
Stick.
I don't know. I think we'll have to follow it and see what happens. But is anybody, Angela? This is no surprise to you.
No surprise.
Tell me what you've heard.
Because you don't have to add liquid
alcohol.
So the intent is that it's Kool-Aid for grown-ups, but. Yeah,
like powdered sugar type stuff.
It's like Pixie Sticks.
Pixie Sticks.
Powdered alcohol product, and it's coming in rum, vodka, cosmopolitan, mojito, powderita, and lemon drop. My favorite.
Has anybody tried it?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I don't know. Anybody
warns people not to snort it, which, of course, means they will be.
Exactly.
Yeah. They can be sprinkled on, too.
Yeah, that would be. Yep.
So what kind of BAC is like? One packet gives you a buzz of what?
It's the equivalent of one drink,
supposedly. Yeah, it can be easily concealed and brought into concerts, school dances, sporting events, sprinkled on food. It's probably maybe a diet sensa, and can be snorted. Yeah. This is really bad.
Yep, they're always trying to find new ways every time you regulate
alcohol.
Yeah, basically.
Creates significant health risks, as did that 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So we'll have to watch and see what the legislation does.
What do they do with 4Loko?
Well, it's now illegal.
It is?
Yeah. People to the high heavens about it. Yes, they finally...
That's
you
a
can't,
good thing.
Yeah, it's a very good thing. But it starts, you know, and then legislation and technology's got to try and keep up with it.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add? I'm not fully prepared to add one more tidbit to this, but if we're looking at sort of concerns that are on the horizon, the medical marijuana compassionate care bill is being... discussed again in Albany and
for New York.
Yeah, for New York, and has a lot of momentum. They're using, of course, a legislative process to get it up and around the committees, like so that it gets a vote. And maybe next time I can have more of the outcome data from places like Colorado and all that, where no matter where you stand on the issue of marijuana for consenting adults, the diversion rate to youth in particular is astronomical. And Colorado is really having some struggles with lots of enforcement issues, youth diversion issues, deaths. Things people don't know how many cannabis gummy bears to eat before they throw themselves out of a building.
The edibles seem to be the biggest risk
edibles
for death.
Edibles are huge risk for death.
The edibles.
Because they were saying, you know, you had more lung cancer, they didn't want them smoking it, so they were like, okay, let's make brownies and food and everything else.
I mean, it's people are more terminally ill, though, compassionate care.
Not in Colorado. Recreational. But even before that, just on the medical piece, you know, the average... I don't have all the numbers in front of me, so I don't want to, like, quote numbers. But, I mean, they were basically white, middle-aged men with, you know, shoulder pain. They were not people with MS, cancer, HIV. That's not who was actually getting the cards. And now, I mean, my brother-in-law's a judge out there. And the family court judge and the stuff he's seeing is just out of control. You know, grandma and grandpa don't know where to put their, you know, hot yogurt. Or I mean, there's so many products that it's in everything. And the volume of marijuana or THC that you can have as even a tourist, not a resident, is huge. And so they're having trouble with it crossing the borders. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, so it is something that we need to be mindful of. And it just came across my desk before I came here, so I wasn't able to read everything. But that bill is back up, and it's sort of flying against the governor's 20 registered facilities. So that was his proposal, was to have medical facilities do actual research and studies and a limited scope. And this bill actually is sort of legalizing it across the board is the proposal. So something to be looking at.
Which is scary, especially when they've already researched the young population and what it does to their development and everything else. It's like they think they can set an age and it won't go over those boundaries of ages. You know, it's not realistic to think that way.
No, and it's, I mean, I've said it in probably this setting and other settings, that Tompkins County has a higher than national average usage of marijuana products
in the youth, in our youth. That's right. It was lower with alcohol
and tobacco,
right? And tobacco, mm-hmm. But it was really high in marijuana.
Yep.
So yeah.
And what I see, because I work with a lot of youth, is it used to be marijuana was a recreational drug. I mean, literally, you mm-hmm. could hide, you know, after school, work, or whatever was going on. And now people are just working that way all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not to name names, but I just. You know, my 8-hour shift, you know, everybody around me is pretty much stoned the entire time. And I didn't really catch it at first because they're almost so acclimated. But
That's scary.
It's a 24-hour lifestyle.
And they're operating that way. They're driving that way. They're going to work that way. That's scary. Sergeant, what I wanted to tell you, this group, because I didn't kind of fill you in very much, was crafted with some of the CJATI people, the Criminal Justice Alternatives to Incarceration County Board, and for public people to figure out as we work through the system how we can reduce unnecessary incarceration, safely reduce unnecessary incarceration. So we're working through the system and seeing where discretionary points are, how it's done, the thought process in it, what some of the judges do, and things like that. So.
Our goal was to increase necessary incarceration, because that is typically, even though it's the other side of the spectrum, is what we're having the biggest problem with.
Yep. So one of the things I was going to hand out, Linda, this will look very familiar to you. It's your baby.
Yeah.
When we did our jail study back in 2006. I love it because it is very easy to follow. It plugs all the points of where people enter the jail from. Mm-hmm. And I really like it. It's simple, but it really... and then from last meeting, Jason was good enough to have his handy-dandy software, and Joe was great and did it on a color printer, which I don't have. And that's the flow chart. That's basically those two sheets up there.
In a lot better
format.
Some makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and it will be easy to go back.
Do you have any more of these color flowcharts?
We will take those next. Because they're like gold on a colored printer. So let's start. We'll let Joe get in and out. And Judge Rossiter will be here probably within 20 minutes. You want to do the magic marker, or are you going to make me do it this time?
I don't think I was very successful.
Oh, I thought you did. I think I put these backwards, though. I think this was the first one.
Yes, it was. We started with the rest.
Yeah, usually you got the rest before your brain.
Typically, that's what happens.
Yeah, it's just
it works out that way.
It's in much better format.
Yeah.
It's cold, and it's always colder on that side. So you never want to be in this room in the afternoon.
Oh, it works. You know that we could read the article in the Times about reducing energy costs. That's why all the radiation is best. It dries out of suits and ties and stuff. It doesn't have to be so air conditioned.
Okay.
It's all for it.
Good plan.
Your rebels start coming in your, you know, short sleeve shirt.
All right. John, we're going to start with the rest, and we'll do boxes. I'm not sure where IPD will do things differently, you know, than the other one, than the sheriff's. But can you, like, come up and... Because we may refer to that... Yeah.
Okay.
You have to go to the blackboard now.
You don't want me writing anything. It's my handwriting's horrible.
You did do that.
Okay, good.
See, we started with the arrest here, and then you either have, you take them away, or you release them with an appearance ticket. So when you respond, how do you, what makes you determine?
It depends on what the offense is.
Okay.
No, I mean, obviously, there are things that we have to arrest somebody for. If it's domestic harassment.
Like the felony.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, harassment, that's a...
So this is what we're talking about with the Sheriff's Department.
Right. So okay. You tell us how
so
you do it with...
So police officers, sheriff's deputies, peace officers, they all operate under the same guidelines of the CPL, essentially. So
okay.
Anything that they would be required to make an arrest on, we would also be required to make an arrest on.
Okay.
So as far as traffic tickets, you know, it's at the supervisor's discretion, say... Somebody has a history of not showing up for court, and they're not licensed. As a result, an officer may call me on the radio and say, "Hey, I've got this guy. He didn't show up for court." A while ago, when we had full staffing, we would say, "We'll absolutely bring them in. We'll either take $100, which they never have on them, so that requires an arraignment. So if it's during court hours, we would have, you know, them brought to court."
So right there was a difference. You said you guys can take bail.
Right.
See, the sheriffs can't do that. So tell us how that works. That's going to be setting bail and releasing, or ticketing and releasing? How does that work?
So what happens is when you take bail, essentially, with the CPL for a violation, be misdemeanor, you can request $100 bail. I think that's the maximum for A misdemeanors and felonies on up.
Like 100 for violations,
yeah.
A and B misdemeanors,
200
felonies,
okay,
500,
so yeah.
Is that?
Right, so
okay.
We set an appropriate or realistic amount of money that somebody can come up with. And if they have it on them, or if a family member brings it in, you're basically securing that money and ensuring that they come to court. Otherwise, they forfeit that money. So
so you take the bail.
Right.
And you what, give them a ticket?
We give them a receipt. Now it's like in triplicate. One copy goes with the money, gets folded up, and we put it in a lockbox that's on our wall in dispatch. And then they get a copy, the defendant does, or whomever posted bail, and then a copy stays in the book.
Okay.
And then they get an appearance ticket for court?
Yeah, in conjunction with that, there'd be an appearance ticket for court.
Okay.
But there's also the option of just giving an appearance ticket and not taking them into said bail. Correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And, so, and whose choice is that?
It's typically the supervisor's choice, whoever's in charge of the road patrol.
So if I'm remembering correctly, in the sheriff's department, there's no supervisor involved. Is anyone else?
They can't take them.
Right, right. But on the question of,
do
we give an appearance ticket or do we take someone for an arraignment, I'm hearing you say the arresting officer needs to consult with a supervisor. But I think what Sergeant Van from the Sheriff's Department said is that it's the officer's discretion rather than a supervisor's. Am I right about that?
Whether they issue a ticket or have to take for an arraignment, and it depends on if there's bench warrants, they haven't
right.
shown.
Right, but the, my understanding was that the decision was made. Right, but my understanding was the decision between arraignment and appearance ticket was the guy in the field, rather than calling into a supervisor.
I'm not dead sure of that, but that's my recollection.
I think that's what he said.
Just noting the details. I'm not sure anything hangs on it.
Right.
But I'm noting that seems to be a difference between the two agencies.
But there's always a shift supervisor, and I don't believe they would ever be calling the judge without the shift supervisor knowing what was going on.
Right. I think what he said, is it Sergeant Van?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That if there's going to be an arraignment, they'd be calling in, and the dispatcher would be making the arrangements with the judge. So I imagine the supervisor would be aware of it. But I gathered, and again, I may have misunderstood, that if the decision was made to just give an appearance ticket with no arraignment, it wasn't apparent that the supervisor would be involved in that case in the sheriff's department.
We can check with
him. Yeah. If we're just looking for where the decision points are, I think that's worth noting.
It says in the notes from last month that the officer decides.
So I'll determine whether or not the circumstance requires an arraignment. And with aggravated unlicensed operation, we've seen them come in, be arraigned, and then be released. So, you know, so typically, you know, if we're at minimum complement, that means we have to take an officer off the road that has to sit with that defendant and wait for the judge to become available, and sometimes it can be very convenient, sometimes it can take a very long time. So typically I'll make a discretionary call to essentially release them and ensure they don't drive. So, and that's worked out pretty well for us. That's just for a AUO ticket, unauthorized, or I'm sorry, not being licensed.
Which is a violation. Is that a violation or a
misdemeanor? Depends on what level it is. It could be an unclassified misdemeanor.
Okay.
You said that if the person has a history of not having appearance in court, how do you check that? Do you check that automatically from the car?
So for a traffic violation, they can run what's known as a D group, which is it shows the driver's history and what's known as scoffs. So they'll show up as S-C-O-F-F, apostrophe S's, scoffs, and that's established by the court. Yeah. So that means that a person had a speeding ticket, they had an arraignment date in court, or they had a court date, they didn't show up for that court date. And the judge did what's known as scoff law on them, saying that they're going to remove their license. They sent out a certified letter, and if they don't respond, then their license gets revoked through DMV. So if they have 14 scoffs on their license, of course we're going to, you know, require a bail or arraignment.
And you can see that automatically, like right from after you stop them, like you don't have to call.
No, we have to call dispatch, or the officer can run it on their computer, but it's far more convenient to have dispatch on that.
Gotcha. But I'm not sure we should be concerning ourselves with those people because they're not going to go to jail. They're in traffic.
Right.
Speeding or moving violation.
Unless there's a bench worn out for them or something like that. Well, but those are the circumstances where they would be.
Right. The other one we have like all the time is petty larceny.
Yeah,
so that's something that they have to be booked on, fingerprinted, photographed. So that's something that they're going to be coming to the station, unless there's some extreme circumstance. Somebody's at Walmart, she has, you know, 5 young kids with her or something to that effect. They live locally, we know they're going to come back to court, they don't have any warrants on their history, then that's the type of thing that, you know, they could call the supervisor, and I would typically say, you know, release for the appearance ticket. So other than that.
Finish that sentence. Other than that,
if there's no, you know, other circumstance, you know, such as that, then they'd be brought into the station for a booking.
Does that mean that then there's going to be an arraignment, or might there be a booking and
an appearance ticket, or there could be an arraignment. If it typically happens during the daytime when court's in session, you will bring them up to court after we've booked them. When the accusatory has been constructed, then if it's on the weekend, if it's, you know, a more severe case, we will ask for bail or arraignment. Typically, bail is designed to ensure that somebody returns to court. It's not, I mean, people associate it with a punishment, but it's really not that. You know, and so if we have somebody who doesn't have a history of warrants, we would most likely elect to give an appearance ticket if we didn't have a judge to come in.
And again, whose decision is that? The shift supervisor?
Yep.
Is that the sergeant on duty or lieutenant?
Sergeant or lieutenant or...
Somebody on the road patrol?
Yeah.
It's road patrol supervisor.
Yeah, each of our shifts has two sergeants and a lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And if they're somehow absent, which rarely happens, then the senior officer is called the officer in charge.
Mm-hmm. What do you think... What happens most often?
From my perspective, I'm a day shift sergeant on patrol. So I typically see the people coming in from Walmart, Wegmans. I mean, you would not believe the call line we have from the big box stores down there, and a lot. So then it's very convenient. The courtroom is right next door. We book them, process them, fill out the accusatories, and typically bring them upstairs for arraignment. That way there's no question. They've gone through their arraignment. They have to come back for their court date.
Then what happens? What do the judges generally do with
them? I mean, I really can't answer to what the judges do. I mean, I was serious when I it wasn't a joke. I mean,
that'd be a good Judge Rossiter one.
Yeah, I mean, we see a lot of people, getting released on their own cognizance.
With a ticket, an appearance ticket, or no?
Well, they would have a court date, so they'd get a court, the court paperwork once they've been.
Can I ask another question? Okay, so there's going to be, if you're making an arrest outside of 9 to 5, there's going to be some cases where it's cut and dried, you're going to want an arraignment.
Right.
And there's going to be other cases where it's pretty cut and dried, that all this needs is an appearance ticket.
Right.
I'd imagine that there's a middle slice there where it might be hard to decide.
Yes.
What's the kind of case where it's going to be harder for you to decide which way to go?
I would say that if somebody doesn't have any ties to the community, they're from, say, Elmira, or they're from Hartford, Connecticut, for example, mm-hmm. somewhere else, and they're just in for the weekend, that's a bail situation, or even an arraignment situation. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's been violent is definitely, somebody we're going to hold for arraignment. Probably not even use bail for.
Okay, but that wasn't my question. My question is, what's the ones where it's going to be difficult for you to decide?
I don't think it's difficult at all. I mean, I walk in and I talk to somebody, do you live locally? Do you have business in town? How long have you lived here? What's your address? If they have a good ID, and I don't see any reason why I should think that they wouldn't come back, mm-hmm. they'd always be an appearance ticket. Okay. I mean, I can say that bail doesn't happen very often on my shift, during the day shift. On the evening shift, with students, they take bail, frequently, I would say, for, petty offenses, because you have somebody who may not show up for court, and then graduates and leaves. And I'm also in charge of the warrants, and that's the majority of our warrants are violations that just didn't come back to court. That answer your question? Not really.
Mostly.
Okay.
The concern of this committee is with trying to reduce jail population.
Right.
So what I'm trying to get a handle on, where is the threshold of when people are going to end up getting jailed, if only briefly, versus an appearance ticket at the scene, or they may get taken to the station and get an appearance ticket, or they may get taken to the station and set bail, post bail, and walk. Or they may get taken for arraignment, at which point they may post bail or get released on recognizance or go to jail. So what I'm at least trying to track is after we remove several groups from the vast pool of people that are stopped, who are the ones that end up out on Warren Road?
Right. I see. Well, I can tell you from a police standpoint, you have an extraordinarily difficult task ahead of you, because I think that your only variable is to increase leniency, because the crimes aren't changing, right? In fact, we've only seen more and more crimes. We're seeing new dynamics with drugs, different types of drugs, different scams and such. So the crimes aren't reducing at all, and the severity of crimes are staying the same. Right, so you're going to have to change the criteria by which you jail somebody, And that would only mean, if you're looking to jail fewer people, you're looking to select a group of those arrestees and say, you don't have to go to jail anymore. You used to, you know, 5 years ago, but that's not the way we do things anymore because we're trying to save money with the jail or we're trying to do something. Now, does that make, you know, provide a disservice to the community? I don't know. I mean, that's something for, you know, the constituents to decide. But
let's tag team while Judge Rossiter's here. Well,
I'm just wondering, you know, Eric, does substance abuse play into the decision? If someone's high, drunk, belligerent, out of control, is that going to make a sway?
Right, yeah, I mean, if someone's, you know, we'll say, you know, highly intoxicated, number one, my first responsibility is to make sure that person, if all of their administrative things associated with the arrest are completed, I can't just release them into the environment.
So I think that's what kind of is.
Yeah, right? I want to make sure that they don't go out and harm themselves or do this. I can't even tell you the number of times we've had people, you know, processed, arraigned, released, go back right back to where they were before, do the same crime again, and the next thing you know, they're back in arraignment, and that's when we say, "Oh, that's enough."
That's when my mind.
Yeah. Right.
And
so
you can move them in the city. There's like a city. Holding tank.
Yeah, we have six male cells, two female cells in a processing area.
So they won't necessarily go to...
That's reserved for crimes that you want to arraign somebody on, can't take bail for, or they don't have bail, and the judge isn't available because it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm not going to call you.
They're being nice. They're being nice to the judge.
Exactly.
So Sergeant Norman's got to the point, Judge Rossiter, where like during the day, you know, even for petty stuff like the Walmart things and things like that, if there's court in session, they'll bring them in before the court. They may release them with a ticket, they may bond them, they may bring them before the court. What do you generally see for those cases? Not the DWI more serious stuff, but for the minor stuff.
All right, let me, all right, so essentially the options are this. If somebody gets arrested, then the police, and I'm just going to tell you what Ithaca Police Department does, and then I'll talk a little bit about county and state because they're very different. Ithaca Police. For the vast majority of cases, and we do, our total criminal plus civil is about 15,000 a year.
Ooh.
15,000. That includes everything, traffic, everything. So most of what they do for the traffic and the most criminal cases, they will give the person what's called an appearance ticket. 3x5. It just has the name of the court, the date the person's supposed to appear, what they're appearing for. They just hand them that. And that is fined, even if you look at a book on criminal law in New York, as an invitation to come to court. It's essentially an invitation to come to court. It has nothing else behind it other than that. But that's what they do. For the vast majority of their cases, they are inviting people to come to court. So the person takes that, and the date that's on that is going to be a Wednesday, because all the new arraignments in city court happen on a Wednesday morning. If someone declines the invitation to come to court, then we go to the next step. At that point, the clerks in my court will then send a summons to that person, to their last known address, the address that's on there, and then the summons will say, you now must appear in court, and your failure to appear in court will result in a warrant for your arrest. Those forms, before I started, used to say may result in a warrant for your arrest. And I said, well, let's be clear about this. We need to tell people exactly what's going to happen if they don't come. And now it says will result. So at that point, we'll give the person another chance. And if the person doesn't show up for court after that more formal demand goes out, then an arrest warrant can be issued for that person. And then if there's an arrest warrant, that goes back to IPD. They go out and they try to find the person and bring them in. And in a situation like that, if the person doesn't have a good excuse for not coming to court, that's when we start talking about bail. But what you have to understand is for the vast majority of cases, these guys are just giving them an invitation to come to court, or they might be taking a few dollars from this person in bail because they can. There are very few cases that have to go beyond that. So really, that's the vast majority of cases. Now, contrast to that, and they do have a holding cell if they need to hang on to somebody for a few hours and then have a judge come and arraign them.
Maximum 48.
There is nobody that's been kept in those cells for 48 hours since about the early 60s. Okay? I'm just telling you. The last two administrations, there's nobody that's been there for more than a
fugitive from justice. That's been the longest stay, I think.
So, it's been a very, very long time for anybody to spend any amount of time in there at all. Now, as he told you, there are these cells at the bottom of the IPD, and they're so infrequently used that one of the women's cells is like currently filled with storage. Okay? That's how long. There's not a lot of people that get held there.
700 last year, over 700 last year.
So, now, the...
Six female.
So, at this point, the thing that you need to understand countywide, even though there's a jail, the Tompkins County deputies, not the corrections officers, but the deputies, have zero holding cells. Okay? There is no holding cell at the jail. The only way somebody can get into the jail is if a judge has signed a securing order putting them there. So if the county sheriff deputy arrests someone and they think that person needs to be arraigned, they will call up the justice of the peace, or if it happens in the city, they'll call me to get that person arraigned. The county sheriff also, the deputies, do not have any capacity for taking station house bail from people to then give them these appearance tickets. So the number of people that they're going to call a judge or justice for is probably way more than what these guys were doing. Same goes for the state police. They have zero holding cells. If you say to them, why not take some bail, they ask me what language I'm speaking. They have no clue what I'm talking.
State police don't do that either.
State police will not do it. Now, is there anything in a statute that precludes them from doing it? I don't think so. I think it has to do with this is just the way things have always been. You will find the same thing if you get down to New York City. A person that gets arrested in New York City will be put in a cell and will be kept there until somebody can take them in front of a judge. Can they take station house bail in New York City? You bet they can. But do they? No, they don't. So I don't think that there's necessarily a state statute that precludes these things from happening. It's just that more by custom that something has been done a certain way, but it's very different outside the city than what's happening inside the city. But anytime I ever get a call from a state trooper or a county sheriff, if I talk to them about an appearance ticket or this or that, they go, we don't do that. So they have a very different approach to these things. So,
if that were to be changed, assuming that there is no statute that prohibits it, then it's an administrative decision that's made by the sheriff of each county?
In all likelihood. I think that would happen.
Of the sheriffs. I've talked to Ken about it. Yeah. He's talking to the State Sheriff's Association to discuss being able to do this.
It sounds like he doesn't have to ask them to be able to do it.
It's more like whether the sheriffs all want to agree.
What they're going to have to do is set up a system where they're handling money, which is never easy. IPD, they have all the forms there, the bail forms and so forth. They have a bail book. Somebody has to take responsibility for handling substantial sums of money, holding on to it, figuring out where to put it when it's first taken, where it can be counted for, how often does somebody carry it over to the court, get it double counted there, get it deposited in the court account. There's a lot of checks and balances, absolutely right. And I think that that's probably one of the reasons why it just hasn't happened. hasn't happened over the years. Because you can see with the county sheriff's department, I can understand where this would happen, because they're usually located next to the county jail. So all they need to do is go call up a justice of the peace, take the person to the justice of the peace, get the justice of the peace to say, okay, this is what the money's going to be, and then they can take them back to the county jail, and then that person, if they have the bail, can pay it right there, the same building, just different part of the same building, and get to the same place. So you can see where there might be some reluctance or sort of a, do we really need to do that when we have this other system that has worked for them? But it, you know, I think that the people who would have the most complaint, to my mind, would be the justices of the peace, who probably get way more bill the night phone calls than I do, and I get enough to last me for a lifetime, which is the reason why I'm retiring. But the thing, I mean, but these guys, they probably get tons of these things. They probably get tons of these things, calls. So.
And what they said when Jamie Van came, Sergeant Van came, and he said that, you know, when dispatch starts this calling of the justices to find them, and he said generally it's such a pain that if they can release with an appearance ticket, they do.
They will.
If they have to have, you know, an arraignment, then dispatch starts calling.
But the in-between thing is that if they've got the in-between case where they're concerned that appearance ticket might not be enough, but if they can get this person to put up a little earnest money that keep them interested to come back on their own, then if they had a way to, if that was set up, that the person could just post $100, $200 right there, then they wouldn't have to take them to the JP and do that. So,
one more question then. So if the sheriff calls the judge and lets the judge set bail, it's not that the sheriff wouldn't know what the bail should be, because that is statutory, isn't it?
Well, no, there are limits. Basically, there's a maximum. Okay, there's a maximum on what can be taken.
I think Sergeant Van had talked about how much the bails were.
Misdemeanors, $500 on felonies.
Yep, petty offense, $100. B misdemeanor, unclassified misdemeanor included DWI, by the way. $250. A misdemeanor, $500. E felony, $750. I don't know of any police department that's ever taken a $750 bail on a felony.
These are minimums.
Those are the maximum bail amounts that may be set by a desk sergeant.
By a desk sergeant.
Well, that's what they call it in the book. But that's really, desk sergeant is a term they use in New York City more often than not.
Yeah. So the issue is not that they would.
Okay, $100 for petty violations. A B misdemeanor is $250. A misdemeanor, $500. E felony, $750. But again, that $750, you know, it's curious because I think that these numbers were sort of set up with the New York City model in hand, but I don't know any police stations in New York City that follow this. Okay? They don't do it. They just don't do it. They put everybody in the can, and then they make them sit there for up to 24 hours until they put them in front of a judge. Now, does a judge or a justice bound by that? No, absolutely not. A judge or justice, yeah, we're both gimping. The two of us both have the same foot as Ben. The two of us have been gimping around the building for weeks. Okay, so now if you don't do the station house bail routine and the person goes in front of a judge or justice, then the rule is that with a few exceptions, reasonable bail must be set. Okay? Here are the exceptions. A local court cannot set bail on the highest felony, Class A felony. Can't do it. So if somebody is charged with murdering somebody or a really, really big drug case, A felony, no bail. Must be a remand without bail. If the person standing before that judge, and when a judge is arraigning somebody, they should have a rap sheet in front of them. If they don't, then they're not doing a proper arraignment. But the rap sheet, if they look at it, and this person is being charged with a felony offense, and the criminal history shows that this person had two prior felony convictions at any time, not a 10-year limit, any time, then that judge may not set bail. That local judge must remand that person to the county jail, zero bail, to bring them back for a preliminary felony hearing within about 3 or 4 days, hence to do a hearing to see if there's enough evidence to continue to hold him.
Will that be in the local court or in the county court?
That's the local. That's local level. A local judge does not have the authority to set bail on a person charged with a felony who's had two prior felony convictions. Can a person like that get bail? You bet. Of course they can. Their attorney just has to file a writ of habeas corpus in county court, get them into county. County judge can set bail for them at any time. Now, in terms of what is reasonable bail depends on the circumstances. Here's what the judge or justice is supposed to take into consideration. They're supposed to look at whether the person has a local address. If so, how long have they been at that same address? Where have their addresses been prior to that? Have they been in the area? How long have you been in this general area? Is the person currently employed? Do they have any other family members? I always ask about close friends living in the area. You're looking at just basically you're trying to establish some tie to the local community that tells you that the chances of this guy walking out the door and then keep on booking is low. It's pretty low. I mean, you want to make sure that the person has some tie to this community. They got a stake in the game. They're going to come back and going to answer to the charge. And that's what it's about. As to how high can a bail be, the only thing I can tell you is that there is no statute that says that the bail cannot be greater than X number of dollars, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, whatever you want to fill in. What will happen is that if a judge is consistently setting unreasonably high bails, then what will most likely happen is that someone somewhere along the line will file a complaint with the Judicial Conduct Board, and I know of two cases off the top of my head where judges have been removed from the bench for setting bails that were excessive. Two right off the top of my head. I'm sure there are more, but two I can think of, people I know who got removed for that.
Local?
Well, not in this immediate community, no. But, I mean, within upstate New York. Upstate New York, okay? So, that's essentially it. I mean, it's basically that the judge should be able to set forth the findings as to why.
Would they sanction a justice or tell them to get training or something, or do they just
Two that I know of were, well, usually if it's an initial complaint, the person is sanctioned and so forth, but if there's a second complaint of doing the same thing again, that's when they usually talk in terms of removal. So, and the other thing is, too.
That would be up to their attorney.
Here's the other thing, too. In terms of the judicial sanctions, basically, as with all things in life, it depends on what your attitude is when you go in front of the great board who's going to decide your fate. If you go in with a lot of attitude, you're running a risk. If you go in with major mea culpas, mea culpa, mea maxima culpas, then you've got a much better case of them saying, okay, you've seen the error of your ways, and we're going to let you go back to work and do not do this again. So that's kind of it. I mean,
I'm still sort of stuck on that question of discretion. In other words, before, it gets, I'm assuming that by the time it gets to you, Judge, it's one of those cases, one of the areas that we were having, we kind of identified in with the sheriff was people who, for example, do petite larceny or something very minor,
okay.
But because they have these previous records, either of bench warrants, yep. Former failure to appear. And so what we're seeing is that even if the appearing offense is actually relatively minor, what's really getting them in jail is a previous record.
Okay.
So I was hoping you could maybe speak to that.
I'm happy to. Don't be fooled by the name. Just because the first, the first half of the thing is French for little, it doesn't mean it's little. Okay? So the problem is that the way that the state of New York has defined it, a petty larceny is a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by up to a year in jail, 3 years probation, up to $1,000 in fines. So it's not considered. It is, when you're talking about a local court, city court or justice court, Class A misdemeanor is the highest as they go. So a petty larceny, even if it's for $1.50, that's the highest level offense that that local court's going to handle. Okay, at least on a, see it through to the end. Local judges do arraignments on felonies, but then they get transferred over to county court. Now, would it be a good idea if the state of New York decided that petty larceny offenses, petty larceny offenses for small amounts of money, such as anything $50 or less, $25 and less, could be decriminalized and treated as a violation? It would probably be easier for everybody, but it hasn't been yet. And the only one that can make that change is the state legislature of the state of New York. So for right now, that's, you know, that still is not chump change in a local court on an A misdemeanor. Now, when, as I said, if the judge or justice is doing an arraignment and doesn't have a criminal rap sheet in front of them, then they're not doing a proper arraignment. And it's a struggle. So these guys at IPD are great at making sure the paperwork's there, and I think sometimes it's more of a struggle to get it from Cornell Police and other agencies to make sure they have a rap sheet. But when you're looking at that rap sheet as a judge, you need to look. Does this person have a history of prior bench warrants? Because the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior in that sense. So if this person has a habit of not showing up for court, then that's going to ring some alarm bells for that judge or justice saying, wow, this guy doesn't show up for court. So that's the problem that, you know, you run into. Now, you can't always predict. Sometimes you can put bail on somebody and they still skip. And other times, you know, you can release somebody on a relatively serious looking offense, but you can feel pretty solid that they're going to come back because how long they've been in the community. And one of the benefits of having done this for 21 years, I pretty much know everybody who's in front of me, and I kind of can almost guess whether they're going to come back or not. And so that's not as hard to figure that out. But I can tell you that I had many, many years ago, if you remember the old College Town Creeper case, mm-hmm. We had that guy who was peeking in windows and came into court. He was only being charged with a misdemeanor in city court because they didn't have anything more than that on him. And he came in, and I set, on a misdemeanor, $5,000 bail. Now, I'd never done that. That's a lot of money. When you figure that the maximum penalty for Class A is $1,000, I just went $5,000 on bail. But this was a high-profile thing. There was a lot of incentive for this guy to run. And guy gets his grandmother to put up her house, post the bail, and he booked it for California. And that's where he later got arrested in California. Now,
he came back, too, though, didn't he?
Nope. He stayed. They let him get prosecuted out there because he had much more serious offenses out there. So we took care of it that way.
Did the grandmother lose her house?
At this point, I didn't even want to know because I don't know how that got resolved, but somehow that would have had to have been resolved, and whether or not somebody made her come up with the $5,000 to cover that, probably they did. But that would have been me. Because all I could do was just issue the warrant. But that was a case where this guy, I put high bail, and this guy took off. Now, there are other cases where I've taken a chance and released somebody of recognizance or released under supervision or probation, had them go over to Pat's office, check in once a week. They had a felony. There was some blowback that I wasn't setting bail for this guy, but I knew that they would come, and they did come back. So it depends on what you, and that's where it's something where you have to look at what ties does this person have in the community. And there are times when I'm doing an arraignment and there are 8 relatives sitting there, local people, and I have a pretty good feeling that this person's not going to take off because here's all these family here with them.
Right. I think what we're trying to identify is, say, for example, you might think that they're not a flight risk, right? But let's say you set $250 bail or mm-hmm. et cetera, and this person can't pay it because they're poor.
Mm-hmm.
And then they end up in jail, and then the operational cost for that is there. So we're trying to figure out how do we get that population not necessarily to go to jail, but to maybe go out.
That's the population that Debbie will deal with through OAR. that if this person does have a tie to the community, then there will be the opportunity for OAR to post the bail for them to get them back out. And that's, you know, that's case. And believe me, the one thing that I have tried to do over the last 20 years is to make sure that OAR doesn't lose any of those bails. So if they put bail up for somebody and the person doesn't show up for court, I don't go ahead and grab that bail right away. I will have a clerk call them and say, we got one of your guys on the loose. Go get them in here, so we don't have to forfeit this bail. Okay? Try to save them their money so they don't lose any of that money and that they get it back when this person comes back to court.
Linda? This question is for the sergeant and the judge. Does the fact that someone's currently on felony probation and they're charged with a felony, does that influence whether or not you issue an appearance ticket or have them arraigned, set bail? Is there any way that influences how that case is handled?
It depends if they're on felony probation for their second felony, but probably not. Usually if somebody's on felony probation, it would probably be for their first felony.
Right, right.
So bail, in theory, could be set for that person, but I would think that there'd probably be a more likelihood of hanging on to them and calling at least probation officer or calling a judge before.
Yeah. We have the contact numbers for probation, so we would call a probation officer. And I think that we would opt for an arraignment probably.
Something on that.
Especially if it was a felony.
So it's usually going to be a violation.
Right, well, that's what I'm thinking.
And if it's during the day when I get a hold of somebody for probation, I've certainly on many, many occasions, I call probation, get a hold of whoever's, the person supervising this person. Let me talk to them on the phone right now, saying, how's this person doing? Are they showing up? Are they having any problems? I got to do charge here, you're going to know about it anyway.
Okay.
What would you recommend? And I'll get a recommendation. And of course, anybody who's being held on bail the day after an arraignment, as soon as they go up to the jail, bring that stranger from Pat's office, goes up, interviews them, not about the case. She will not ask them any questions about whether they did what they're charged with doing. She's just going to be asking them questions about how long they've been in the community, what their ties are, all those things. Who do you work for? Give me a number for somebody that can put a good word in for you, and then she'll file that with the court. And those things we take, I think they're invaluable. As soon as you get one of those and go through it. And
plus we have that objective failure to appear.
Yes.
Compass scale that is very objective, which gives us a low, medium, or high risk for failure to appear.
So let me try to rephrase this another way. Who are the population of people that you wish you could let go of, but you can't because there's guidelines? Or that you would think, okay, I have some discretion here, and they could, instead of ending up in jail, be released?
Because
that's what we're trying to get at.
let me
put does that it, make sense?
Okay, let me just put it this way. I don't know if you guys remember when we were looking at the initial program for using electronic monitors for release. And back when we first started that program, one of the things was that electronic monitor had to go into a phone, telephone, okay? Well, what we found after looking at this thing round and round and round was the population who would benefit from it was pretty close to zero, because the only people who were being held are the ones that didn't have any ties to the community. So telephone, geez, they didn't have anything. I mean, there was no phone we could hook the EM into to get them out. So it was that was sort of when it was came home in a big way of saying, geez, we really are, at least, was pretty confident that the people that were going in were the ones that really didn't have any connection. Now, having said that, I don't want you to think that I'm restricting that to a real house, because these guys can tell you that, for all the years I've had court officers at IPD, before I went to the state security, I would, if somebody came in and they said that their address was the jungle, I would say to the court officer, you know where he's camping down the jungle? And they go, yeah. I go, okay, fine. I would take the jungle as a legitimate address for purposes of release, because I had an officer who says, I know exactly where he's camping. I used to joke about we should put up mailboxes down there so we could send the notices and somebody would deliver them to the right guy at the right time. But so I, you know, I don't want to think that the person got a phone home before they get out or anything like that. Absolutely not.
Is the phone
the rescue mission is a good address. You know, Friendship Center is a good address. Yeah. These are all good addresses, as far as I'm concerned.
Is the phone thing still a requirement?
No. It's technology.
Right. Yeah, it runs on a battery.
Yep.
So you don't have to have a landline anymore.
Right. You just have to be able to charge the battery.
To be able to charge it. Yeah. And you have to have some accountability and being able to charge it every day, because if you lose the battery, we're not tracking anybody.
Exactly.
So the phone thing is not an impediment anymore.
No. Are there then situations where the person can't be released with the monitor because there's no recharging available to them?
They're homeless,
yeah. Yeah. People
they
charge
in the library.
They go to the
they
library.
Charge
they go
to the
clinic.
It's not for everybody. The EM, I would not recommend putting EM on someone who scores a 10 out of 10, who has no ties or has a history of absconding, because it's expensive equipment. And they take off and run with and cut it off somewhere.
They cut it off as a new felony, too. Yeah. So, you know, you don't want to run the risk of somebody's going to get frustrated with it and cut it off.
So it's more for the medium-risk people. And so then we have other alternatives. We have release to burn debt. We have release to day reporting, which sometimes fits. It's a better fit for those kinds of
things. What I'm looking for is... Are there exceptions somewhere on the borderline of people who are somehow missing the boat because in the older days they didn't have a phone, or now because charging is an issue, or...
I don't think so. I read all those reports, and I can't
speak to what other judges do. I can just tell you what I do. And, you know, I treat the jail as a finite resource. I know, you know, how few beds are available up there at any given time. One of the things that, you know, I got here when I got here today because I was doing drug court. And for misdemeanor drug court, I drive everybody crazy because misdemeanor drug court is an alternative to incarceration. So I always have team members saying, give this person a jail section. And I go, that's a pretty expensive fix here. So instead of that, we do community service, we do day reporting, we do all that stuff, we do electronic monitors for some of those folks if they're acting squarely. But I rarely will put somebody up there in jail, out of that program, and then if I do have to do it, as for as short a period of time as I can. At the same time, are there times when I got to send somebody up there on bail because they have a history of not showing up court, and maybe I've had issued 2 warrants for them already on the same bloody case? Yeah, you bet there are. Are there times where somebody's had been in court 4 times in the past 5 years, and previously we've done a conditional discharge and then a probation, they violated probation, and then they get arrested again, and does there come a point where you have to give them a jail sanction as punishment? Yeah, there does come to that point.
Could
be
sure, could.
Yeah,
yeah,
it could. If they were over and over and over again.
Yeah. Joe? You're going to be ticked off because this gets us away from the flowchart a little bit.
Oh, that's all right. I've
been doing this for a long time. You know the system pretty well. You know that our goal is to try to reduce the number of people who are spending time in jail. Do you have thoughts on ways that we could...
I do. I'm not sure if I can share all of them.
You're a short timer.
I am a short timer.
So you're safe.
10th of June. No, I'm not a fan of the justice court system. That's all I can tell you. Never have been. Never will be. I don't see the state changing it any. But I think that it should have been changed a long time ago. Unfortunately, now it's so entrenched, it won't change.
When you say the justice court system, what are you referring to?
Lay judges. People who have never been to law school. Who are currently have the same criminal jurisdiction that I have. Yeah. And I did suffer through Cornell Law School. I did graduate. I did then work for several years and practice before I was even eligible, so trying to become a judge. And there, you know, you can't substitute for that a couple of weeks at some dog and pony show that's given.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody used to sell shoes.
Yeah, I got it.
We need to
you got the background.
But within the context of what we can control.
Let me give you an example. This was a statement made by a justice of the peace years ago who's now dead, so I can tell you the example.
I bet I know who it is.
You didn't kill him, did you?
No, I didn't. I stabbed him, believe me, because at the time I was representing a client from him. But, you know, I went into this justice, and I had a client who was charged with a DWI. Now, the person had been released by the police agency who had arrested him, released on the day in question. I come back into court with this guy later to be arraigned with counsel, at which point this justice, and I, you know, I went through this guy, he had a job, he had a local home, he had everything, every bail criteria you can think of. And this, the justice's thing was, that's going to be $300 bail. And I just sputtered, and I said, Judge, my client showed up on his own with an attorney, has a local address, has a job, zero flight risk. What would be the basis for bail? And the response I got was, that's what I do in every case. That's my essentially my standard operating procedure. Okay? That's wrong. That shows just such a misunderstanding and a misapplication of the law that it's disgraceful. Okay? That is wrong. Now, whether things like, I said, I'm telling you a story about a dead person who's no longer on the bench. I'm not saying that there's anybody that's doing that now. But I'm just saying, this was the kind of thing that was happening at one point. At least in one court by one justice. And that's what makes me nervous. That makes me nervous.
Is there something that maybe with a little creative thinking, a little bit of resource, we could create or form that would provide you with an alternative to some of the lesser serious incarcerations? Creatively thinking. We're trying to think outside the box.
Is there a tool you wish you had
right. That
would let you avoid jail in some situations
like
where you
supervised
have
housing, transitional
well, the,
housing?
Yeah, I mean, I always used to tell the joke in court when somebody would talk about day reporting. I said, hell with day reporting. I need night reports.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Because most of the people get into trouble, they got in trouble between 5 p.m. and 5 a.m., not, you know, where day reporting, yeah. You know, starts bright and early, and most of the, you know, most of my frequent flyers aren't up yet. I mean, they're still sleeping off from the night before. So, I always used to say that I don't need day reporting, I need night reporting. And, yeah, now, could that happen? I don't know. You know,
why not?
We tried a day release. We had a day release program at the jail for a year. I don't remember.
Jail?
Yeah. Do you remember that?
Probably.
The Works
program.
Yeah,
the,
oh, really?
Well, yeah, we had that. We had the Ricks program up there.
Right.
Frank Joseph used to run that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was, they would go out during the day and then come back to the jail at night.
That doesn't reduce our cost, though.
Yeah, it doesn't reduce the cost. But, I think what you're talking about, if you're going in a different direction, you could do the equivalent of Rick's program where people go out and do community service or do something during the day and then come back to the secure facility at night.
Yeah,
okay?
House,
yeah. Now, of course, the thing is, you know, that kind of thing is still, it's not going to be cheap.
No.
Okay? You got brick and mortar expense, you got supervision expense, you're going to have to figure out who's going to be screening these people, make sure they're not secreting drugs back in at night, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But
if you could have a night shift probation officer who could do night reporting instead of day reporting, might there be cases that would work for?
Right. I mean, no, I'm talking about, if you're probation reporting would just be a probation officer meets with somebody for anything from 10 minutes to 30 minutes, just check up on them, make sure they're doing things. I don't see that if we're having people report at 2 o'clock in the morning instead of 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't see where that's going to help us any.
If they got to show up sober.
But, well, yeah. But it's basically, it's just not, you know, then the problem becomes, okay, the person shows up drunk. What does this probation officer have to do with them now? Do they have to call a cop to come pick them up?
Do they have to call you?
Yeah, it's just, I'm not sure that would do anything more than you know, just generate more costs to the probation officer with not a lot of bang for the buck on that, I would say.
Right.
But, no, I think that, you know, if you had a brick-and-mortar facility where people, you know, instead of the jail, where people were doing day reporting and then going there at night, yeah, maybe. But I'm not even sure how many people that would fix.
Yeah. What difference would it be?
Yeah, it might not make a lot of difference other than, you know, there might not be quite as many people working it, but at the same time, who are these people who are working it? You know, what kind of training would they have to have? Would they have to be police officers? Would they have to be, you know, peace officers? What would they have to be? Would they carry a weapon? Would they, you know, there's so many things in there, issues of liability. This is much on my mind because it's, you know, been very difficult for me the last couple of weeks. But one of my drug court guys, after spending an afternoon with me in court where I thought we were good and he was ready to go, and he had secreted drugs and died that night at the jail. And, you know, I'm not looking forward to that memorial service this weekend, but, you know, that's kind of thing that it happens.
Yeah.
I just, one reason I'm running late today, I just had to sentence a guy who was supposed to show up for a sentencing on Friday, and rather than doing that, he went out and used a bunch of drugs and OD'd, and they had to ship, he spent Friday in the hospital instead of in court. So, you know, one of the things that a lot of the guys like to do before they go to jail is they like to use something or try to sneak something in so they can take the edge off their time.
Mm-hmm.
And it is freakingly dangerous.
Yeah.
And they're doing it, and it's, you know, I can see where you'd have that kind of thing occur over and over and over again at a facility that was a non-jail facility more than what it can happen at the jail. And the liability there, that could be devastating. That could be devastating for the county. That would really make me nervous. Because right now, even with all the precautions that the jail takes, when somebody comes in, they can do the rectal search, they can do all that stuff, they can check every orifice, but if the person swallowed something, they don't know it's there. And then if it bursts during the night, game over. So, so even all the precautions they take, stuff can still happen. And a lot of these people we're dealing with are flipping desperate. They will do anything to get something into their system. And it's just, it's tough.
Would it be related to the fact that there's no treatment for the people that are sent to jail that are going to be in withdrawal?
Oh, we have. We got more stuff than most places.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of things that we have that are extraordinary. One of them is that if a person is going up there who has a problem with heroin withdrawal, which is a biggie now, Dr. Bezerganian will actually go check that person out and then put them on Suboxone while they're at the jail.
How long has that been in place?
Oh, my God. We've been doing this for years.
3 or 4 years?
Three or four years?
A few years.
Nope. Bezerganian's been doing this. This is phenomenal.
It's one of the only jails in
New York
State.
It is probably about the only place that does it. Okay? It's phenomenal that we do this. That John goes up there, he checks these people out, he gets them on a Suboxone.
On his own license. He uses
There's
a finite number of people he can prescribe.
We have two doctors. We've got the doctor over at CARS who can put people on Suboxone too, and John Bezerganian, both of them can do it. Now the problem for both of them is there's a limit of how many people. They can carry.
Or a self-imposed limit.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, because of how many people they can see.
No doctor is obliged to take on.
Right. And, you know, they want to make sure that they can keep track. If they hand them out like M&Ms, then they got a problem of trying to keep track of these people or their patients. But he's been doing it for a long time.
I asked the question because it wasn't my experience when I was there.
Well, that may be the limitation I wasn't aware of. That
my personal experience, but
not everyone's getting it.
Yeah. Well, no, because not everybody is appropriate for it.
I'm not saying not everyone who is withdrawing from heroin and other opiates is getting, let me put it that way.
Okay.
So I know others aren't.
Are the two doctors enough to pretty much treat everyone that is appropriate?
Nope. No.
We need more doctors?
No. They wouldn't suggest that they work. No. They're both stretched. They're the limp. There's no question. Totally. They're both stretched and limp.
And if I may just, as far as I'm concerned, the jury is still very much out on Spock.
Yeah.
The more it's sort of, you know, it was when Prozac first came out. Doing that kind of work. You know, it looked like one kind of thing, and then 4 years later, it looks like another kind of thing, and then 8 years later, it looks like another kind of thing. And we're into that iteration. The original Suboxone was originally 3 months, we taper off, and everything's okay.
Yeah.
Now it looks like you're going to be on it like you're on insulin.
Yeah.
You might be on it for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, in theory, the idea was you put somebody on it, it was a taper thing where you got the person off the heroin, onto the Suboxone, just like methadone, and keep them on it for a while, and then slowly get them out of it and taper them down to nothing.
Yeah. It's the same for detox, right? That's
the idea. But the big detox is booze.
Yeah.
Most of the detox from drugs is more, this person's going to be, miserable, grumpy. But the story I've always been told by people in the business is if you lock up 4 alcoholics in one room and 4 drug addicts in the other room and leave them there for 3-4 days and come back, when you open the door, you're going to find 4 grumpy drug addicts. In the other room, you find 3 grumpy alcoholics and a corpse. That the detox from alcohol is way more difficult.
It's a dangerous medical issue.
It's dangerous.
It's a medical issue.
And so for the medical issues are way more dangerous.
And the jail does have a Librium protocol for detoxing if it's severe enough.
Yeah, but they do way more at Tompkins County Jail than I'm sure any other facility upstate, at least maybe the entire state, for intervening with people. And what I do personally, again, I can't speak for any other judges, but when I'm arraigning somebody, if they're presenting and having issues, the reason why they call me is that this person just really, they can't even talk to them. I come over, I always say to a person that I'm arraigning, I'm going to ask you a question, not because, I'm not asking you this to get you into trouble or get any more charges filed against you. I'm only asking you this because I would like to know. I want to keep you safe, and I would like to know what we need to be worried about. And I say to the person, are you taking anything now? Have you taken anything recently that you're going to start detoxing on if you get up to the jail? So that I can tell somebody what to do for you. Now, because I've been doing it as long as I have, and people know who I am, most of the time they will answer my question, tell me exactly what's going on, and then I will just put a note at the bottom of the securing order, this person may be detoxing from heroin, from oxy, from alcohol, whatever it is. And I put that note on there just to give an alert to the medical staff up at the jail so they're going to know what to look for and what to address once the person gets there. Mm-hmm. But, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that every arraignment I've done in 21 years was perfect. But I would guess that I probably erred as much on releasing somebody I shouldn't as putting somebody up there I didn't have to. So that's the only thing I can tell you. There are times when you got to send somebody up. You don't have a lot of choice in the matter because of what they're presenting, what their history is, what they're being charged with, the way they're acting, and so on. But what we also do, because city court is open every day, we get the person back within a couple of days and see if circumstances have changed, and we don't try to keep anybody up there longer than they have to be there. And now, again, if you're looking at the justice course, these are operations that might only meet one day a week, once every two weeks, something like that. So if they're going to send somebody up, that person might not get back to that court to get arraigned with an attorney or whatever. It can be, a couple weeks sometimes?
I got one now if there's arraigned.
There you go. So if somebody gets set up with bail, and the next time they come back for a bail review is 3 weeks. I would never do that.
This one didn't qualify for OAR because I have a history.
Okay. Yeah. No, I wouldn't do that. That's just not the way we operate in city. So, yeah.
I can shift the focus back to the issue of alternatives to jail.
Yeah.
The impression I've been getting through our discussion over the last couple of months is that if we start with the pool of people who have an initial contact with a police officer or a sheriff's deputy, the majority of them are going to get an appearance ticket.
Police officers.
Right. And a subset are going to get taken back to the station. Of those, a majority, if it's a IPD, are going to get bail set at the station and are going to go home. But there's a subset that's going to get arraigned.
Okay.
And of the people that are arraigned, probably a majority that are going to get released on recognizance or released under supervision or set bail that they can make. And it's, again, going to be a fraction that's actually going to see the door. So we're already taking a fraction of a fraction of a fraction.
You're absolutely right.
But that somehow that fraction of a fraction of a fraction is growing by about a half to 1% a year. And that's what's created the problem that we're trying to solve. So I'm trying to figure out what is it that's making that seemingly tiny growth in a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, where there's discretionary points. For my impression is that somehow where there's discretion, and there's multiple points of discretion, that people are just making the judgment calls a little bit different than they were a few years ago. And I'm not sure how you get a handle on that.
Okay.
John, you and the judge respond.
Has anybody actually looked at the number of people who are being incarcerated? And so you're saying that there's a trend, is trending upward. Has anyone compared that to our increasing population globally?
You mean the general population?
Yeah, to compare it to demographics.
I'd also want to compare it to crime rate.
Right.
Okay, so in other words, is there a growth of crime commensurate with the growth of jail population or not? And I don't think we've seen that set of statistics yet.
There's also legislatures increasingly tightening penalties.
Mm-hmm.
For DWIs, for instance, has been doing some.
There's mandatory jail time that goes along at least 5 days for felonies and so forth, that even if the person's a good judge. Yeah.
We're getting an awful lot of numbers that tell us everything except what we want to know.
Yeah.
I think that my opinion is it's Justice Courts Plus.
But
Justice Courts
Plus. Yeah.
Well, I think that, like, in every region, in you know, urban environments, you often have, you know, X number of people per thousand will commit a crime. And that is pretty much a benchmark. So you'd have to start there and say, this is our population. This is our population 10 years ago, number of incarcerated people 10 years ago, number of people incarcerated now and every year, and compile that data to ensure that you're not completely off base. I mean, I know we're trying to save money is what basically the ultimate goal is, correct? So obviously you have to look at the amount of people that live in the community. So then, I mean, when I said earlier that you're kind of dealing with it from the opposite end, you know, I think that I've heard a lot about early intervention for kids at risk. So where would you find that population of kids? And the payoff isn't immediate.
Right.
I mean, you're going to have to sink money into it, but ultimately you would hope that it would be, you'd have greater success. So you would find that population visiting their parents at jail. Right? Because they're the ones who are, their parents are leading the example, and we can say, as police officers, you have, you know, senior in jail, junior is 15, and we're already having a problem with him, you know, and next thing you know, that kid's in jail. So you should have a kiosk or information or somebody who's working with the people that are coming in, and if you're going to sink money into something, that would be what I would say you'd sink money into, because you might be looking at a 5-year-old kid who could be channeled into a better direction, or you might be looking at a 15-year-old kid who's already starting to show the signs that he's going to end up incarcerated. You know, I mean, I don't think that, you know, trying to give the judges a tool to release people is going to be in the interest of our community, because there are people who work every day and go home to their families. And they're becoming victims of crimes, and that's frustrating for us because we're seeing the numbers increase. But like I said, I haven't seen it absurdly outside, you know, the data for the growth in population either.
Yeah.
Also, what percentage of the people who are being incarcerated are on social services? And is that data that can be ethically collected? you know, and say, is there a relationship between people having, you know, lots of time to do something, and maybe there's something else we could be having these people do to make sure they don't have the opportunities to commit crime?
Well, there's a correlation between poverty.
Right.
Let me tell you one thing you just said about the early intervention. I don't. Were you on with me the old Tim Joseph committee where we looked?
Yes.
It was called What Works.
That's
okay.
Right.
Best committee. You were on that too, Linda,
right?
That was probably the best committee I've ever been in in 21 years. And that one of the things it always stayed with me. There were a couple of things that came out of that committee, and one of them was that in certain types of cases, in family violence cases, what worked was a pro-arrest policy, but not necessarily a pro-jailing policy. So if the consequence was merely that the person was arrested and brought into the system, it didn't necessarily mean that they had to go to jail, okay? Now, there was a lot of sentiment for many years around here that if it was a domestic violence, this took on a whole different tenor. That this was something that you treated completely different from any other garden variety assault, and if this person, you know, should go to jail. Now, whether that's still happening, I don't know. But certainly, that committee found that all the empirical evidence showed that as long as the person got arrested, putting them in jail didn't give you that much more bang for your buck. The other thing that the findings from that committee showed, which was fantastic, was that if you did early intervention with families in the second to fourth year of life, that gave you the biggest bang for the buck of anything a community could do, bar none, for making sure what you're talking about, that as the kids grew up,
that was
done by visiting nurses and all that kind of stuff.
Previously in Elmira with the visiting nurse.
Yes.
Family partnership.
They did it in Elmira.
Showing that the intervention with the kids early on got you a return of $8 for every dollar invested. That's pretty incredible. And I've always wanted to put it on the front end instead of the back end.
Yeah, makes sense.
The other thing we need to remember is the crime rate is very different from the jail data we're looking at, because not everybody that gets arrested, certainly by far, goes in the jail.
Right.
So we need to remember they're two entirely separate things. And how we would find the crime rate, I'm not exactly sure.
Aren't there official statistics?
Yeah,
we can get some DCJS stuff.
But it's very broad.
But it's very broad.
We can't get things like a count of how many petty larcenies are there in the course of a year.
They collect, the police agencies collect differently. The state police collect their stuff. You know, towns and villages, some of them are using SJS. I don't know what that's new. They're not all hooked into it.
You would have to go to several sources to add them together to one number.
Yes, that's correct.
And they have to be reported, and they have to be reported correctly. So.
Yeah.
But if we're trying to make year-to-year comparisons, presumably
but
the proportions are about the same.
But the crime rate, Eric, is different than what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
So, Jason,
but we're also talking about, if we've been talking about pre-conviction incarceration, which is what all the bail, and then there's post-conviction. So they're two totally separate groups.
Right.
Yeah. We're starting to mix the two.
So the question, do I understand this correctly, that the whole point pre-conviction of sending somebody to jail is primarily to keep them from running away?
Exactly.
If you're
officially
not afraid
that's exactly
that they're
right
going to run away, then there's no point
the
in sending them to jail.
The purpose of bail post-arrest is to assure reappearance in court a later date to address the charge.
And the only
that is
time,
what it's supposed to be about, yes.
And the only time it's statutory is if they have two prior felonies.
And they're being charged with a felony now.
And they're charged with a third felony. Then
yes,
it's statutory.
Or else if they're charged with a very high-level felony, which is an A. We don't get very many
like
of those in this community, thank God.
But otherwise, in those situations, then it's required
not only
that they be held in jail until they are convicted or not.
Until somebody in county court, superior, one of the county court judges, or when I was as an acting county court judge, when I'm an acting county court judge, I could do it, but I'd have to be sitting in county court to do it. I couldn't do it local.
To set bail for an A felony.
All right. Setting the bail.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
And after the bail is set, then that person could be released until their sentencing.
The bail's posted.
Bail is set, then
a person could post it. Now, it doesn't mean that the first bail that's set stays at that level. That's where Bernadette Stranger in Pat's office serves a very big purpose, and she goes up to interview these people. She files reports with the local court, and when the person comes back for arraignment with counsel or their next appearance in court, there's usually a report from Bernadette saying, Joe Schmo's sitting up there, and you know, we've done this analysis and this analysis, and we think that the likelihood of absconding is low, medium, high.
It can be more than absconding, though. Can it also be their probability of being a danger to the community? For example, let me use an example. Yeah. For example, in somebody with repeat DWIs.
Not by statute, Ken.
Not by statute, no. But by common sense, a judge can look at this person and say...
That's prior convictions. It's the record.
It's the record. So you can look at somebody's record and say, I don't want to let them out because it may be 6 weeks before the court they get into court again because I think they could go out and reoffend.
Now we're sort of getting into minority report status. I mean, now we're getting into the movies. You know, you're looking into, is this person thinking evil thoughts that they could go out and reoffend in the future? I would be a little nervous about that. It's more that, again, as I said, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior in the sense that has this person shown up for court in the past?
So bail's not punitive, but is bail's not supposed to be punitive. Ever taken into account when someone
bail? I would say
for DV cases,
but not by statute. I mean, this is something that do judges do it? Yeah, they're human beings. Sure. Okay, they're gonna if this person is there. I mean, here's the other thing: you look at it two ways. There have been times where we've had, going back a few years now, we had two different groups that were kind of going at each other one after another, back and forth. And like every other night, there was another incident. And so it got to the point where we go, okay, I'm putting you up so for your own safety so somebody doesn't get you, tomorrow. You're going to consider that to some extent, but that's not a primary factor in doing it. If you have if you are concerned about things, you issue orders of protection and so forth to order the person to stay away, and you warn them. If you violate the terms of this order of protection, you could be arrested for a new charge. And if there's a new charge, then I will reconsider this bail situation. This bail situation, the fact that I'm going to release you is with the understanding you will not reoffend. If you reoffend and you're back in here, then I might have to consider a different situation.
Well, Judge, you just mentioned one a little while ago with Mr. Story.
Yes.
And that was one I can remember distinctly having conversations with you saying that this guy is escalating to the point where that the public's going to be in danger. And that's when you set $5,000 bail on...
On a name misdemeanor. It was high bail.
And... But that was a case where there was communication between the police and the judge, and he absconded and did get arrested for attempted rape
in California.
In California.
Yeah. Now, let me just put that in perspective, that $5,000 bail. It was the only time in all the years that he was DA and I was judge that George Dente's ever said anything nice about me. And he said that after Story absconded, George said to the paper that the judge had set $5,000, and that was a substantial bail for this particular for the type of offense that he was being charged with at the time. So he could have taken a cheap shot, as he usually did, and said, that damn activist judge, blah, blah, blah. But no, that time he even said that was a substantial bail for what this person was being charged with, and he still absconded. It happens.
But that was a time where public safety had to overrule...
And that's why we have to safely reduce the population. Mm-hmm. We can. I don't think anybody wants us to unsafely reduce the jail population, and that's what the judges are for.
Yep.
So, quite honestly, I don't have a problem with that. John and then Eric and then John. Yeah.
You said a few minutes ago that, rightly, that the official purpose of bail, is to ensure appearance.
Yes.
But certain. I haven't been involved in the system, especially in the last 20 years, but back when I was aware that especially in some of the justice courts, there were judges who regarded that as optional. I'm remembering a conversation I had with one justice who said something along the lines of, I'm not going to set bail for a week to teach this guy a lesson, and then we can set bail and let due process play itself out. But he was clearly just using delay in bail as a way of getting in a punishment before we've had an adjudication. And I don't think that was all that unusual.
Probably still isn't.
It isn't unusual
today. I'm not going to argue the other point of view. Because I can't. So, yeah.
And we have to focus on what can we impact. What can we change? What can we? What do we have control over? Not the getting
not the
message
local
out
court
there.
System,
not
the,
not no. the getting them. We don't. We not this.
Not through this
but education. Education is key. You know, getting the message out there that you know taxpayers don't want to unnecessarily be paying for jail days.
Yeah, I was just going to say that one of the things that plays into that is that a lot of times if you're a judge, nobody's going to come up to you and say, you did the right thing, let that person out. What members of the public do is they'll come up and say, way to go, give them help, lock them up.
Especially when they're elected.
They think they're being cool. They think that's a cool thing to say. Now, somebody said to me, you know, I don't have an agenda, I'm just doing my job. And, you know, I deal with them as I see them, and that's it. So, but that's one of the problems. You get that kind of feedback from the public.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So, is the majority of money we're spending in the jail, is that for bedding out inmates? Or is that when we exceed the population that the jail can have?
That is something that, and first of all, I don't know if this is really all about this front seat.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I understand.
What's happened here is because of the project for jail, it's kind of elevated the issue again about how many people being needed in jail and what else can we do. So it's not all money driven.
Okay.
You know, one of the factors is if we can reduce that population, we can house more people here, which is good because we have more services here to help them avoid coming back.
Family contact.
Sure. Okay. So that was one part. The second part is, and this is for Judy, I'm looking at the data here as far as how many total jail days there were in 2013, 27,400 plus, and I'm looking at the number one reason that accounts for those jail days is for due to larceny, petty larceny.
Yep.
Is the first, and then you know in the top 10 are all sorts of other larcenies. You got grand larceny, first, second, third. Is there something that you can think of as an alternative for the petty larceny? Yes, I think we're thinking 10% of the jail days are associated with larceny-related offenses.
Okay. Those are countywide numbers?
Yes.
Is it pretrial or sentence or both?
That's a good question. Doesn't say so.
Unsentenced? I think we only
actually both. The highest volume both sentenced and unsentenced.
And that's their highest crime.
And that's not, I mean... Obviously, petty larceny affects everybody. It's someone walks into your garage, steals your lawnmower. You pay a higher price at the store because they're stealing food. I'm not saying reduce people's responsibility to be good citizens, but I'm thinking, is there something other than...
A judge mentioned changing to a violation. I mean, under state statute, if you could change it for a crime of less than 100 to a violation, you could take care of a chunk already. I mean,
here's a couple things.
It's also in the service of drug use. I mean,
it's not just
somebody going and stealing deodorant.
Right.
They're stealing something to sell to support their...
Well, and when we've looked at some of these that were in there for a long time on petty larceny, you found, where did they live? They lived in the jungle. They had substance abuse issues.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't bailed by OAR. You know, even though it was low bail, they weren't appropriate.
Yeah.
Look at
so there are all there are other things going on.
There's usually other things holding them at the jail.
Yeah, okay, that's
other,
yeah, absolutely.
Other
that's
retainer
the,
warrants
yeah.
from other courts.
Right. Yeah, the other that's thing warrants. To understand is, let's say that there's somebody who did time in state prison. When they get released from state prison, unless they maxed out, they're usually released on parole. Now, if a person gets arrested for a new charge in the, anywhere, then what happens is that their parole officer is automatically notified, and pretty much 100% of the time, the parole officer then will drop a detainer on that person, and then they can't be released from the jail. So they're going to be sitting there until such time as their parole matters resolved. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be a population of that who might be up there for what looks like a relatively low-level offense as far as the local case is concerned, but the real problem is parole. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, what's the best thing I can do for that person? I'll put some bail on them. So they're going to get credit for the time that they're going to sit up there anyway on a parole violation, because if I don't put any bail on them, they're not going to get credit. So then they're really behind the eight ball. So
that's the credit.
Well, in other words, you only get credit, in other words, if they're only being held on parole, and as a local judge, I haven't put any bail on them, then they don't get one day credit for the local case because they're not there on my order. They're not there on my order. So, you know, so there are people like that.
We ask for bail.
Yeah, usually the defense attorney, if they know what they're doing, is going to ask for bail. Say, give me some bail on it. Because I want this person to get credit for.
And parole's been having harder and harder times getting warrants for technical violations.
Yep.
They're ending up, the parolees are staying out.
So one of the things that's tricky about this list that John's got is that there might be some stuff on there, charges that look like they're piddling, completely piddling. But one of the reasons is that if I'm going to put bail on something for somebody, I have the clerks tell me everything this guy's got pending in our court right now, even down to the traffic tickets, so that if they're going to be up there anyway, I want every single charge listed on that order, because then later, if the DA says, okay, you can plead to number 5 in satisfaction of everything, I want to make sure 5 was on that order so that we can settle the case and the person got credit for being there for everything at once. That's just smart to me. That's just a way to be efficient in court, and it'd be dumb to do other than that. But you're going to end up with a bunch of piddling little cases that are charged.
At least on some of the charge, parole violators are broken out separately.
Okay.
Yeah.
But this, same guy with a parole violation might have 3 traffic tickets of city court that I would have put bail on to make sure that while they're up there.
The thing with the kind of law states, I mean, usually no one's going to jail their first time.
No, definitely not.
Usually it's not even bail the first time, it's a ticket.
Oh, they give tickets. They give appearance tickets.
But even after conviction, I mean, unless it's something egregious that somebody wants to do jail time, which occasionally happens.
In excess of 95%.
I want to touch on that because I have an uncle who recently retired from the jail. He was a corrections officer. And we would have conversations sometimes about people we knew in common, and the same names would come up over over again.
Yeah.
Hey, you're getting back John Smith. Oh, no.
He's going
back again.
Yeah.
You know, so the number of total jail days, I mean, and it's something that could be obtained from the sheriff's department is names associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
See who is being incarcerated most. See what their offenses are, and then go out and give that person assistance. It could be as simple as having a conversation. Why did you spend the last year in jail? Explain to me your circumstances. How could, you know, what are you going to focus on? Because if it's literally, 75 people that we are all familiar with that are spent, and you said it right off the bat, the majority of people don't, it's kind of a, they call it petty larceny for a reason. It's the base level of thievery, and they don't end up in jail the first time for that. So there's something else going on in these people's lives that is making them steal over and over again to end up in jail.
There did come a point where the state legislature many years ago, probably like going back 30 plus years now, where they increased the level of grand larceny and petty larceny. They raised it up. Now, when they did that, here's what they didn't do. It used to be like $250. Everything above that would be a grand larceny felony. They raised it to $1,000. Now, when they did that, for whatever reason, at the same time, there's another charge called criminal mischief, where rather than stealing something, you broke it. That one, they didn't bother to switch. So that one, they left it $250. So if you break something worth less than $250, you get charged with a misdemeanor. If you break something that's worth more than $250, you get charged with a felony.
Like one plate glass window.
Pretty much. That's my point. Inflation has passed that by, okay? So you get a lot of criminal mischief thirds, felonies, which are going to trigger an arraignment, and if it's a, I look at that and I go, okay, in my mind, I do a calculation Okay. I am 93% certain that the DA, when they look at this, is going to knock it down to a misdemeanor. Therefore, it's not as high-stake poker. Otherwise, somebody else may look at that and go, that's a felony. Got to put him in jail. It's a felony.
It depends on the
okay?
DA.
Right? So, but that's the thing. Now,
Judge, is there a lesson there? If you break it, just go ahead and steal it.
Exactly. Stealing it, then breaking it is the point. But here's the thing. You know, I started with legislature could knock down a little tiny petty larceny down to it. Are they going to do that? No. And I'll tell you what. Again, they don't have the stomach for it. If they get to the point where they decriminalize marijuana, that's going to be about as heavy a lift as they can ever do. I can't, you know, right now, all of the public sentiment and the push is towards making things harder, making punishments tougher, going after DWI people in three different more ways than you used to. There is no intestinal fortitude in the state legislature for somebody to stand up and say, I move to decriminalize theft in stores down to a violation. That isn't going to happen. That's not going to happen. So
we've had conversations with, like, Judge Rowley and stuff on the local judicial level where they would like to see, like, harassments that get pretty nasty.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they don't quite
harassment's
reach to
a violation.
Assault, but
yeah.
Harassment's a violation, whereas petty larceny is a misdemeanor. Yeah. And they would love to have them flip that.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing. So it's kind of, there's crazy, these are old classifications, and you're not going to get, I don't see the state legislature sitting down seriously looking at it and making adjustments. I just don't see it happening.
Maybe we could bribe them.
So we have just a little over 5 minutes
left. I don't know if you have that much money. If you have that much money, you wouldn't have a problem at the jail.
And I want to wrap this while you guys are here, and thank you so much for coming. I hope it wasn't so painful you won't come back, because I think you're valuable in this process. One of the things that we've looked at is the beginning, okay? I would propose, I mean, what I think I was hearing out of this are all the places where we don't have the ability to change things. The sheriff is very willing, and maybe we need some chats with the state police to see what we can do as far as the bail, whether they can take bail or not. That may help.
Because the number will be lower.
Because the number will be lower.
Okay.
The number of what will be lower?
The bail. Because the station house bail, remember, station house bail is pretty low.
100, 250.
Okay?
Those are low bails. Right.
They could take a tiny amount of, they could take a much smaller amount of somebody, give them an appearance ticket, end of story. Once they get past that and put them in front of a JP, then the bail could be higher.
Then the bail goes up. Brian?
Just on that as well, you would cut down operational time.
Yep.
That it takes to go
to get a judge
for a
reason.
That's
right.
Hold them
That's right.
until the judge gets out of bed.
That's right.
Goes to the court.
So,
I mean, we're talking hours.
So I'm seeing potential here.
Yes.
Anybody disagree?
Especially since the jail already takes bail money on the corrections side, it shouldn't be that many crazy unorthodox hoops to jump through.
And they're willing to look at it. They're willing to work on it. Working with the State Sheriff's Association to see if we can change that. And Tompkins County is a leader in other ways. I don't see why we can't do that. So that's what I see coming out. I see that coming out of this first part. Now, my question is, so from here, we're going to do the plea, conviction, whatever, and do it to sentencing and look at that population. The other thing we need to do is, at some point, and I'd rather do it sooner, is set the meeting to give public input. Okay? So I'm kind of thinking maybe we need to do that next. We've been talking about it. We've been promising it. I think that there's, you know, a segment of population that would like to come and speak.
We'll have to do it before it's full summer.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I think we should set that date. And then move on to looking at the second part of the process to sentencing. Any thoughts?
Susie, why don't you send out a meeting wizard with, like, three dates to this committee about dates for the public meeting?
For the public input meeting. Okay. One of the things that we talked about is the Board Warner Room at the library. Pretty community-oriented.
When's it available?
That's what I got to find out.
Well, then why don't you
That's going to probably, if that's where we would like to have it, because it's pretty community-friendly, I will check on the dates. It's available. Do a meeting wizard. But we're going to have to do it quick. So when you get it, respond, send it back, because I think that it fills up with community
you know, forums and things.
It's not free.
It's not free?
For one room.